Fan's ultimate goal was Taiwan, not Vietnam. But he had to get out of Hong Kong, and this group had helped him do just that. Taiwan still felt like a long way off, but Vietnam would work for now. And he didn't think either the mainland Chinese or the unknown Westerners who had attacked the ship 3 days earlier, just before they set sail from Po Toi Island, would find him here. He could not have understood the scope of the hunt for him, and he could not have been more wrong. Chapter 11. Court could have done without the four assholes trailing him from the hotel this morning. Shortly after beginning the operation on his second day in Hong Kong, he'd performed a quick SDR, entering and exiting a few electronic shops along the way, looking out into the street through the store windows. He bought a couple of items. Court was a kid in a candy store with all the low-cost and high-tech gadgetry on offer. But mainly, he was in counter-surveillance mode. He picked up the tail quickly, cussing under his breath as he made them. The men tracking him up the road traveled in a pair of small four-door sedans, and he assumed they were MSS. With just a quick evaluation of their procedures, he could tell they were cut from the same cloth as the two men he'd killed at the peninsula, and a similar ilk to many he'd seen at Dai's safe house the day before. Court stepped back out of an electronic shop with his purchases in his cargo pockets. In his hand, he held a new mobile phone, and as he started walking north, he dialed Dai's number. The call was unencrypted, but Dai didn't seem to give a damn.
"Yes, it's me," Court replied. "What is this phone you are calling me from?"
"Doesn't matter. It's a burner. I'll be using a different number each time we talk," the PLA colonel answered.
"Suit yourself. What have you learned so far?"
"Only that you are not a trusting guy."
"What does that mean?"
"Four guys on my tail, two vehicles. Do you have more ready to follow me to the MTR, or will the passengers in these two cars have to bolt out and catch up if I go down an escalator?" Dai did not reply to this. Court said,
"I work alone.
I can shake these guys or you can call them off. It's up to you." Dai said,
"I am impressed with your abilities. I will recall my surveillance team.
If you send others, I'll see them too. But if I see them, it might mean the people holding Fan see them, and I don't think that's what you want."
"No one wants that. Remember, Sir Donald's life depends on your success."
"I'm here for the payday, Dai, not for the old British guy. I'll kill Fan Chiang for you, as long as I'm not the front end of a block-long parade of mainland Chinese gunmen." Court hung up and kept walking towards the Prince Edward Metro station, and then, as he began to take the stairs down, he turned and looked behind him. The two vehicles had peeled off somewhere in the past block, and he saw no one on foot who looked overly suspicious, although there were easily 300 people moving along with them here on the wide sidewalks on Prince Edward Road, so it was impossible to be sure. Satisfied he had done all he could do to ID any persistent surveillance on him, he descended into the MTR station, keeping his eyes peeled at all times for anyone who seemed interested in his movements. After a 30-minute transit across waters almost as crowded with maritime traffic as the sidewalks of Hong Kong had been with foot traffic, passengers on the Stanley Po Toi ferry disembarked at the public pier on the southwestern side of the little island. Court gentry moved down the boat ramp along with a mix of tourists, fishermen, and trinket merchants, then lagged back on the dock, letting everyone continue on ahead of him. Court had spent some time looking over every cove of Po Toi on Google Earth, and to him it didn't appear like there was much of anything going on anywhere else on the scrub-covered rock other than here, in the little bay in view from the pier. His research convinced him that he was right. The total population of this island was only 200. He gazed out across the placid water of the bay as the other passengers kept walking. Ahead on his right was an open-air seafood restaurant with a wooden roof. In front of that, men who rented kayaks and boats sat in the sand next to their little vessels, looking expectantly but with noticeable frustration at the small number of tourists disembarking from the ferry and moving in their direction. Court noticed a few buildings along a poorly maintained road that ran near the beach. On the far end of the bay, on the opposite side of the water from Court, a footpath ran along the waterline, past a smaller restaurant bar that looked derelict and closed. It was open air as well, with a tin roof and a deck that hung out over the water's edge. Shacks ran up the steep hill above the bar, and the path continued to the left where, out of court sight, at the end of the trail, he knew a Buddhist temple sat alone on a little cliff over the water's edge. He'd read that tourists visited the temple not because it was all that special in itself, but rather because of the nice pictures one could take of the ancient site in the foreground and the turquoise water of the South China Sea in the background, along with tiny rocky islands jutting up in the distance. Court pulled his binos out of his cargo shorts and focused them on the derelict building on the far side of the little bay from the public pier. The walls were open so he could look all the way into the dark dive, and he didn't see anyone at the tables inside. Panning up, he noticed the sign was in Hanzi, standard Chinese lettering. There was no attempt to draw tourists to the establishment, and it was half-covered in scaffolding made of bamboo lashed together with rope. Initially, it seemed like the place was closed, but now he noticed smoke from the kitchen rising out of the chimney and hanging over the shacks above it on the hill. The place looked like a dump. Most anywhere else, even in Hong Kong proper, it would probably be condemned, but despite its outward appearance, it seemed to be open for business. Court walked down the pier towards the beach road, trying to put himself inside the heads of Fitzroy's three men who had come here 4 days earlier. What were they looking for, and who would they go to in order to find it? Fitz had written in his notes that his three operators reported following a speedboat full of Wo Xing Wo men here from the Kowloon Peninsula, but they didn't know if Fan was with them or what the triads were doing here on the island. It had been 11 at night when Fitz got the call from them, so Court surmised Fitz's men hadn't taken the ferry, and this meant they must have had a boat of their own. The public pier was really the only place to dock on the island that he had seen from Google, although, without knowing how large Fitzroy's men's boat was, it was hard to know if they'd just driven right up to some stretch of beach and landed themselves, or even anchored offshore somewhere. The British ex-spymaster had relayed that it sounded like they were calling from a bar, so with little else to go on, Court decided he'd ask around at the bars here in the bay to see if anyone remembered the three Englishmen. A few minutes later, Court stepped up to the door to the Ming Ki Seafood Restaurant, right on the beach next to the kayak renters. Bright English signage welcomed tourists, and Court planned on entering right behind a group of Austrians from the ferry, but he stopped abruptly at the door when he noticed the hours of operation posted there. He saw that the place closed at 9 p.m., just before the last tourist ferry left the island. If Fitz's boys didn't make contact with him until 11 p.m., and they did so from a bar, this seemed like the wrong place to ask around about the three Englishmen. Court decided to go to the more rustic establishment on the far side of the bay, thinking it might cater to anyone who lived in the shacks and any boaters anchored overnight nearby. It was just a 5-minute walk around the water to the footpath that led to the restaurant. The sun's heat scorched his arms and lower legs, but his ball cap shielded his face. He walked just behind a few tourists from the UK heading to the temple, and he listened in while they considered dropping into the restaurant ahead for a beer before continuing their walk. As a group, they decided against it as they got closer. The place really was a ramshackle and unwelcoming hole in the wall. Court saw no English language writing anywhere on the small sign in the front of the little establishment, but he did see from the hours posted on the door that the place was open till midnight each evening. If Fitz's men had been here following triads, and if no other part of the island was built up, then it was quite possible, likely even, that Fitz's men had come to this bar. As he entered the corrugated tin-roofed building, he expected to be the only Western face in the place, so he was surprised to see a pair of young Caucasian girls sitting at a table along the railing, looking over the side, down to the water 10 feet below. Each of them had a bottle of Tsingtao beer resting on the railing in front of them. Other than the two young women, a man behind the bar sitting on the stool and playing a game on his phone, and a mature woman at a table reading a newspaper, the dark little establishment was empty. Court scanned for security cameras as he moved along the chipboard and plastic sheeting walls of the dive towards the bar, and he decided quickly that the proprietors of this joint had spent the full measure of their technology budget on the 3 bug zappers hanging from the ceiling, certainly not on any sort of CCTV security system. Court sat quietly at a stool at the bar for 30 seconds, just feet from the bartender, but the young man remained huddled over his phone. Moving purposefully low profile around the world meant sometimes Court didn't get the best service, but he took advantage of the moment to continue checking out the facility. A couple dozen plastic tables surrounded by 3 or 4 dozen plastic chairs, some sturdier aluminum bar stools around the cheaply made wooden-topped bar with a warped surface that indicated it had seen a lot of spilled beers in its time, and likely some monsoon rains dripping down from the bad roof as well. Court was certain the builders of this place had violated every single building code known to man. There was some concrete block construction in the corners here and there, but the overwhelming majority of this little dump seemed like it could have been built in a day by Boy Scouts rushing through the obligations of their woodworking badges. It looked to the American like a fire trap, a collapse risk, and a germ haven all in one. Court eyed the 2 Caucasian women again, checking them as potential threats, not out of any real suspicion, rather simply a force of habit. One of the 2 was tall and thin, with white blonde hair in long braided pigtails and tattoos on both arms. Her large backpack was on the floor next to her. She wore a cut-off Bob Marley t-shirt over a black tank top and worn-looking capri pants. The other woman was of average height and had an athletic build, and she wore big black sunglasses. Her dirty brown hair was rolled into braids and wrapped in a simple leather headband, and she had a tie-dyed t-shirt and baggy pants rolled up to her shins. Her hemp sandals were cinched around her calves with leather ties. Court put them in their late teens or early 20s, and Western European for sure. Neither girl had even glanced up at Court since he'd entered. They just gazed out at the water as they chatted and laughed, enjoying the view and their beers. Court looked back to the bartender, a young Chinese man of no more than 25, with a round face and thinning hair. The man noticed Court finally and put his phone down.
"Sing Tao, please,"
Court said it with a British accent. When the man returned with the beer, Court kept up the ruse that he was a Brit.
"Is it always so slow around here?"
The bartender chuckled, completely at ease.
"Yeah, man. During the day it is. At night, the boats in the marina and the bay come in, gets kind of busy. Usually it's just my mom here during the day."
He nodded over to the middle-aged woman reading the newspaper at the table across the room. Court hadn't seen much of a marina here, but he had seen a few slips near the pier, all of them empty. The bartender started to turn back around to the cash register to ring up Court's beer, but Court spoke.
"Any chance you were here Sunday night?"
The man cocked his head, surprised at the question, then thought back. His expression seemed to darken somewhat.
"Yeah, till close, why?"
Court pulled out 500 Hong Kong dollars, the equivalent of a little more than 60 U.S. He said,
"I had some mates here on Sunday, around 11. 2 white, 1 black, British. They would have been together. See anyone like that?"
The man looked at the money on the bar for several seconds, then back up at the American offering it. Court detected a slight twitch, a micro-expression, on the man's face.
"We don't get many Westerners here."
Court looked back to the white girls, then down at himself. The bartender said,
"At night, I mean. They all go back up to HK with the last ferry. Try the Ming Key. You passed it coming from the ferry dock."
Court replied,
"I tried the other place, but the Ming Key was closed at 11 p.m.
The bartender nodded.
"Yeah, that's right. I was supposed to meet my friends here, but I didn't make it. Having a hard time running them down since then."
The man shook his head and glanced up and to his right.
"No, I don't remember them. Sorry."
Court affected nonchalance to the man's answers, but he was well trained to scan for clues of deception. While Court's easy smile did not waver, he noticed the fidgeting nature of the bartender. His hands played with the bottle opener now, turning it over and over, and he shifted a little from one foot to the other. Court had established a baseline for the man's mannerisms during their earlier conversation, just so he could pick out any changes when he began his interrogation. When he'd spoken about how slow the restaurant was and how it picked up at night, he'd not been fidgeting at all. The Chinese man turned away quickly and rang up the beer, then put the tab in front of Court.
Sorry, I can't help you. Not so sure that you can't, mate. Anyone else working I can ask? Was your mom here then?
Court saw the man glance a second time out to his right, not to his mother, who was sitting back over his shoulder, but to a point in the distance. Court knew eyes tended to flitter during deception, but it almost looked to Court as if the man was fixing his gaze to a specific point both times. A spot out in the bay? Court had seen a few fishing boats out there when he arrived on the ferry, but he hadn't paid much attention to them. Now he would have given anything to turn around and scan the exact area the man had looked off to. But Court remained disciplined. He didn't want to let on that he'd picked up the subtle tell.
No, she doesn't work at night. We get a rough crowd. Just booze, no food.
Court pulled out another 500 HK dollars.
All right, mate. Here's the deal. I was on holiday with these three blokes from London, renting a flat in the mid-levels. 2 bloody weeks. The fuckers ran out on me a day before we had to pay the balance. They owe me a lot of money, and I'd quite like to have a chat with them about that.
The American had designed his explanation to calm the bartender, to give a credible reason why a man might offer up $100 US worth of local currency to find three other men. But the bartender didn't seem to relax at all, if anything. Court felt like the man's defenses rose even more. He stopped squirming but became ramrod still. His body and his hands seemed to clench a little. Court knew what this was. The man had told his lie, and now he realized his lie wasn't believed. Liars often go on guard to defend themselves, and sometimes they give out physical cues about this change in tactic. But while the man's body remained still, his eyes flicked a third time out to the bay. Court thought he understood now. A boat. The bartender was thinking back to Sunday night subconsciously. He had seen Fitzroy's men, and they'd had some involvement with a boat right out there. But if the bartender had watched the three Brits take a tender out to a boat, why wouldn't he just take the money and give up the information? What was he hiding? The bartender showed his nerves now.
I told you, man, I didn't see anybody.
Just as Court was about to press once more, on his left one of the hippie girls from the table by the railing leaned against the bar and caught the bartender's eye. Court saw that the man was relieved to be rescued. While the girl with the big sunglasses and the headband ordered another beer for herself and her companion in Scottish-accented English, Court sat patiently, waiting for another crack at the bartender. He took the opportunity to fake a slow neck roll and to use the movement to look out to the spot the man kept eyeing. A few fishing boats lulled around in other areas in the calm water, but that part, out past the mouth of the bay, was empty. Whatever boat this man was picturing in his mind's eye was long gone now. The girl returned to her table with her beers, and the bartender went out of his way to disappear from the American holding the two 500 HK dollar bills. He moved back into the little kitchen accessible from behind the bar, threw some noodles into a large fryer, and began turning them over and over with a strainer. Court slipped the money back in his pocket and continued drinking his beer. He decided he'd wait a few minutes, but then he'd take off. As far as Court was concerned, the bartender had told him plenty without saying much of anything. Fitzroy's men had been at this bar. They'd gone out to a boat in the bay, and there was some reason the bartender didn't want to talk about it. Over Court's left shoulder, the Scottish girl looked out at the water while her table mate gulped her fresh beer and talked on and on in English, but in a heavy German accent. The brunette with the braids and the leather headband pretended to listen to the blonde from Hanover for a few minutes more while she glanced out to the bay, then back to the man at the bar who'd spoken with a British accent. She'd heard a slight twanging of his A's when he said the words have and that to the bartender, and to her that sounded like American English. The girl knew languages, accents, and dialects, so she looked at the man again and decided after a time that he was, in fact, American. Her head turned back to the water. Now, the blonde German began wondering aloud how hard it would be to score some ecstasy back at her youth hostel, and the Scottish brunette across the little table just ignored her, shifting her eyes up to the green and brown hills of Po Toi Island. What the hell is going on? She asked herself. The Scottish brunette wasn't really Scottish, and the blonde wasn't really her friend. The blonde was just like the braids, the tie-dyed t-shirt, and the headband. Part of the brunette's disguise. The two had met on the ferry when the brunette had sat down next to the blonde and introduced herself as Lily, then struck up a conversation with Katrin from Hanover about the Buddhist temple on Po Toi. Since they both said they were vagabonding alone around Asia, they decided they'd go see the temple together once they got off the ferry. But on the walk around the bay, Lily offered to buy beers at the less expensive-looking of two bars on the path to the temple. Katrin had to make her money last for this trip, so just about any time anyone offered to buy her a drink, she was up for it, and this was no exception. Plus, Lily had cool hair and cool sandals, so, Katrin figured, she was probably a cool chick. Now Katrin talked recreational drugs while the Scottish girl, who wasn't really Scottish, looked back to the British man at the bar, who wasn't really British, wondering how long he'd been sitting there before she'd noticed him and, even more importantly, how the fuck the Central Intelligence Agency had learned that the Triads had delivered Fan Xiang to the cargo ship here at Po Toi Island. Chapter 12. The woman at the railing, with her eyes on the man at the bar, didn't think he much looked like a CIA officer, but he was American. He was here shaking down the bartender for information, and the bartender was having none of it. She knew this place was a Wo Xing Wo hangout, so either Fan Xing Wang had been here at the bar, or one of the triad men who'd been involved with moving Fan Xiang had talked. Either way, the American had to be agency. The coincidences were too many for any other explanation. The woman calling herself Lily and pretending to be Scottish struggled to maintain a calm countenance. She smiled and nodded at something Katrin said, but on the inside, her guts were turning into knots. The last thing she needed on this op was for the fucking CIA to start snooping around the target area on the very day of her hit. Just as Lily wasn't really Scottish, her name wasn't really Lily. It was Zoya. Zoya Fedorovich Zakharova was about as far from a hippie Scottish vagabond as she could be. She was an operative in the SVR, Russian Foreign Intelligence. She was in her early 30s, but easily passed for 10 years younger. She was here in HK operating with a clandestine SVR paramilitary unit. She and her task force had been ordered to bring Fan Xiang back alive to Moscow, so that her intelligence service could learn everything possible about Unit 61398, including how to infiltrate both China's and America's most secure military and intelligence computer networks. Zoya was the officer in charge of the task force, which meant in theory she shouldn't be out here like this, running low-level surveillance. But she found herself doing most of the footwork on this op herself, because the men working with her were ex-soldiers first and foremost. And while they could shoot and scoot with the best of them, they weren't the slickest bunch when it came to blending into their surroundings. No, low profile was Zakharova's specialty, along with language, intelligence collection, surveillance, and counter-surveillance. So, she was here, playing a role that allowed her to sit in one of only two bars with a view of the bay, to attempt to get a tactical picture of the area so her direct action team of snake eaters would be ready to board the ship when it returned this evening. The Russians knew much of what was going on here in Hong Kong because of a highly placed source in the HK Triads. They'd even known that this particular hole in the wall was frequented in the evenings by Wo Xing Wo men, who smuggled heroin into the city from Vietnam. But Zoya had not known that the CIA was aware of Fan Xiang's existence, much less his escape from mainland China. This was decidedly bad news. The blonde from Hanover kept talking. Now it was a story about buying bad pills in Korea the previous month, so Zoya looked up at her and smiled with an understanding nod. She realized the German girl had no idea the American had even entered the bar, and it occurred to Zoya she hadn't noticed the man enter herself, and this bothered her. She wondered how a man could have slipped into a nearly empty room without being picked up by someone with her skills of perception. A few minutes ago, she had been wondering if the time was right to slip away from the vapid blonde German and probe the Chinese bartender for information. When she'd glanced up, she'd seen the agitated, nervous look on the bartender's face. Only then had she noticed the man sitting at the bar talking to him. It was as if the white man had just materialized on the bar stool. Zoya then stepped up quietly to the bar, under the ruse of ordering another round, in an attempt to listen in, but she'd only heard that the man was looking for some mates. His British accent, while extremely good, didn't pass muster to a world-class linguist like herself. She never really got a perfect look at the man. She thought about a little flirting, using her typical modus operandi and playing the female traveler, engaging another tourist in idle conversation. But something held her back. She sensed a darkness there, a sense of danger to the man. She felt it without even looking into his eyes. He was a serious player in this game, she knew this without a doubt. She didn't want to engage, to risk blowing her cover, so she'd grabbed her beers from the bartender and returned to her table to think things over. And now, as she looked at the American from behind, only seeing flashes of the sight of his face as he glanced around, she realized she wasn't certain she would recognize him if she saw him again. This son of a bitch was that good. Court Gentry decided the bartender was going to stand around in the back and fry noodles until the annoying customer at the bar left his establishment, so Court obliged. He threw a couple of bills on the bar top, leaving a tip for the asshole that he most assuredly did not deserve, because as bad as this man was as an intelligence source, he was even worse as a bartender. Court then slipped off his stool and headed for the exit. Zoya had not noticed the man when he entered, but she did watch him leave through the front door. She'd been careful to track him with her peripheral vision until the very last second he was in sight, and only when the door closed did she look back to her tablemate. Katrin had noticed her new drinking partner looking towards the door, and she followed the gaze. Seeing nothing but a closing door, she turned back to the woman she knew only as Lily.
What? Nothing.
Zoya Zakharova wouldn't attempt to follow the man. She wasn't here to tail CIA officers. She was here to nab Fang Xiang, and in this endeavor, she would stay as far away from the Central Intelligence Agency as possible. Katrin finished the last of her beer now, then spoke in her heavy accent.
Are you ready to visit the temple?
Zoya sipped her own bottle.
You know, I think I've changed my mind. I like this island. I'm going to skip the temple and go find a hostel or a room for rent. I'll spend the night here and check out the temple later.
Katrin took the comment with a look of shock on her face.
There is nothing going on here. I want to see the temple and then take the 2 p.m. ferry to get back to civilization. Discourse, bars, the fun stuff. I thought you said you wanted to party. I'll catch up with you back in Kowloon tomorrow. I need a night of taking it easy to get ready.
Katrin smiled, proud that she was more of a party animal than the cool chick from Scotland. The two girls hefted their backpacks and left the little pub, exchanged emails, and shook hands at the front door. Even young Europeans tend to be more formal than Americans with casual or newly formed acquaintances, then walked off in opposite directions. Katrin thought the two of them might become good friends, perhaps even travel together here in Southeast Asia. Zoya, in contrast, didn't think anything about Katrin. Her mind was on her mission, and it certainly didn't include ever laying eyes on the hippie stoner from Germany again. 45 minutes later, Zoya Zakharova stood at the top of a hill overlooking the bay. Directly below her was a steep decline that led down to a boulder-strewn beach at the water's edge. 100 meters beyond that was the public pier, and 200 meters farther was the far side of the bay and the little dive bar she'd just left. She unslung her backpack and laid it on the dirt, sat on a flat granite rock next to her pack, and pulled out a water bottle. Two beers wasn't anything for her, but she knew enough about her body to know that two beers, followed by a 15-minute walk and then a half-hour steep climb on a rocky trail in direct sunlight and high heat and humidity, would dehydrate her if she didn't replenish soon. As she took a few sips of the tepid water and looked off over the placid bay, she heard a voice behind her, close but muted, as if coming from deep in the waist-high foliage she'd passed before sitting down.
You've got a fucking phone, Koshka.
The language was Russian, the voice was male, and the tone was derisive. Koshka meant female cat, and it wasn't Zoya's real code name, but the men she worked with had taken to calling her that a long time ago. If there had ever been any real reason why, she'd forgotten it. Zoya gulped more water down, ignoring the man a moment more, then said,
America is here, just one man, but I think he's agency.
After a significant pause, she heard another voice from the bushes.
Dermo.
Shit.
Da. Couldn't get pictures or hear much conversation, but he's asking around, something about three British men. Sounds like they might be missing.
There was a rustling in the brush now. Zoya drank more water from her bottle, and after pulling her binos out of her bag, she began scanning the buildings in sight around the bay, a futile attempt to see if she could get eyes on the American somewhere on one of the little roads down there. Next to her, a man appeared, head to toe in brown camouflage, his own binoculars in his hands. Zoya knew Ruslan had a suppressed sniper rifle, a VSS Ventores on a bipod somewhere back there in the brush. Through the high-powered optic on the rail of the weapon, and not through the binos in his hands, he'd been watching Zoya throughout her visit here to the island.
I didn't see you talking to anyone but the blonde girl and the bartender.
I didn't talk to him. I heard him talking to the bartender.
I never saw him.
He's got skills.
Who do you think the three British men are?
How the hell should I know?
Zoya asked, then lowered her binoculars and put them on top of her pack. She unscrewed the lid of her water bottle and drank some more. Another man appeared from the brush behind. He was filthy. He'd been up here all night, Zoya knew, and he smelled like it. He said,
Satellite shows Taichung 6 passing to the east of Hainan Island. At present speed, it will arrive here at 2100 hours tonight.
And we'll be ready for it when it arrives?
She asked. The filthy man said,
Don't know about you, Koshka, but me and the boys are ready for it now.
She thought about admonishing him for the nickname. They were in the field, and she had a code name. Her complete code name was Serena Voshdashoy Travoji, which meant Banshee, but the task force operators were supposed to call her Serena, not Koshka. But she let it go, deciding to pick her battles.
We need survivors, Sasha, she said flatly. This is an intelligence mission, and if there is no one left alive on that ship to tell us where Fan Xiang was taken, then we've all wasted the trip.
Sasha stood over her, blocking out the sun with his wide shoulders.
You will have your survivors to interrogate. I have done this before, you know.
She spun around on the granite rock and looked straight up at the man.
Oh yes, I know. I was there in Kislar, trying to interrogate that one survivor, you know. The man holding his intestines in with his shattered hands? He was rather distracted, barely heard me. Fucking useless endeavor.
Ruslan sighed audibly next to her.
You're never going to let us forget that night in Kislar, are you?
Now Zoya turned to him.
I'll make you a deal. You boys don't fuck it up tonight, and I'll try to forget the debacle in Dagestan.
That would be good for all of us, yourself included, Ruslan said.
Zoya looked at her watch now.
It's 1200 hours. You both can go. I'll take watch on the hide. Have Vasily send another team up here by 1600 so I can get back to the boat in time to prepare a brief for the task force before tonight's raid.
Daniel,
Sasha replied. Understood. Both men turned away from the woman sitting on the granite rock, and they headed back into the brown brush to collect their gear. Zoya called back to them,
Leave the VSS!
She heard a low chuckle from Ruslan.
You gonna shoot the American if you get a chance?
Of course not. I'd just rather use that mounted scope than hold these binos up for the next 3 hours.
Ruslan said,
I'll leave the rifle behind, but you need to remember two things. One, keep your finger off the trigger. And two, there is no round in the chamber now, and I want to find it that way when I get back.
Zoya was quick with her reply.
You need to remember two things yourself,
Sasha mumbled in the brush.
Oh shit, here she goes.
One, I received advanced sniper instruction at Kavkazsky Dvoryk, which, as you well know, is the premier FSB Spetsnaz training facility for long-distance shooting and sniper fieldcraft. And two, go fuck yourself.
Sasha cinched his heavy pack on his shoulders, laughed, and started walking down the hill to the northeast and out of sight of the bay. Ruslan hefted his own gear, minus his rifle. He then returned to Zoya on the rock.
I totally forgot that you were one of the boys, ma'am. I bet you were very popular at Kavkazsky Dvoryk with your tits poking out of your little tie-dyed t-shirt.
He turned and followed Sasha down the trail without another word. Softly, Zoya said,
Mudak,
asshole. She looked down at herself. She was in costume for her cover alias, wig, big sunglasses, ridiculous clothing, and woven bracelets on her arm. Of course she wouldn't be taken seriously by the paramilitary unit working with her. They didn't live in a world that accounted for much art or personal expression. She shook off the hostility from her male colleagues. It was nothing she hadn't heard 10,000 times before. Lifted the binoculars back up to her eyes and scanned out into the South China Sea. Tonight, the cargo ship that had spirited Fan Xiang out of Hong Kong would appear from the southwest. It would be full of drug smugglers, but it would also contain answers to where Fan Xiang went and who was protecting him now. She and her black ops paramilitaries would board the boat not long after setting anchor. They would obtain those answers any way they could, and then they would go wherever in the world the intel directed them, so they could snatch Fan Xiang and take him to Moscow. The men on the cargo ship would know where they had delivered him and to whom, and they would talk. Zoya had no doubt in her mind. It wasn't long before her binos swept back to the shore, and they scanned the streets slowly. She was thinking about the American again. Her mission tonight was going to be tough enough without worrying about mixing it up with the CIA. She didn't need this guy around here asking questions one damn bit. She stood, grabbed her pack, and headed back into the brown brush. She'd climb behind the rifle and scan the bay with the scope for the next 4 hours, hoping like hell everything remained just as sleepy and peaceful as it appeared right now. Chapter 13 Court took the half-empty ferry back to Kowloon at 12:30 p.m., positioning himself in the center of a large cluster of empty seats near the bow on the bridge deck. Court surfed the internet on his mobile during the ride back to the city, hoping to find a shop somewhere in Hong Kong that sold a particular niche item. He expected to find two or three stores at the most selling the goods he was looking for, assuming there couldn't have been that large a market for this type of equipment. Instead, his phone filled with listings, and at the bottom of the list was the option to go to the next page of results. Hong Kong was a mecca for electronics, with no shortage of choices. Court selected a store in Mong Kok, not too far from his hotel, because the area was crowded and not so close to the peninsula, which was damn important to the guy who'd killed two men there 2 nights earlier. An hour and a half later, he stepped into an electronics shop that specialized in high-end optical devices, surveillance equipment, and other wireless mobile security solutions of all kinds. He spent several minutes just reading tags and brochures, familiarizing himself with several items he'd never used before, and reacquainting himself with other items that were upgrades to equipment he'd known all of his professional life. First, he bought a small, handheld thermomonocular that would allow him to see heat registers in the dark, even from great distance. He was very familiar with the technology, but the version he picked up here was a generation better than anything he'd used before. Taking his time to look around at other items, he found something he'd never had access to during his time with the CIA. Clearly, technology for private users had moved beyond what a man in Court's line of work could field just 5 or 6 years earlier. It was a tiny wireless camera that linked with a smartphone and gave the operator the ability to view remotely in regular, low-light, and infrared views, as well as pan and zoom the camera.
For just under $300 each, Court thought they were a steal, if they worked as advertised. And it was Dai's money in his money belt anyway. He bought 3 of the devices. He also bought a radio scanner and another smartphone. Court told himself he'd pick up as many phones as he could reasonably carry around here in HK. After leaving, he took a cab to a scuba diving shop on Sayung Choi Street and bought a mask, fins, and a tank of spare air, a small pony bottle filled with oxygen, used as a supplemental emergency air source when diving. Court knew he might be swimming out to check over boats in the bay tonight, and if he had to do this in a low-profile manner, it would be nice to be able to swim under the surface. An entire scuba rig, a buoyancy control vest along with a full-size tank, weights, and a regulator would be ideal, but this would also mean carrying a bag back to the island the size of a full-sized suitcase and weighing over 60 pounds. Court much preferred cramming the fins, mask, and emergency air in a small backpack along with his other items, something he could drop and run away from if necessary. At the dive shop, he also purchased a small Kershaw fixed blade knife with a sheath he could hang around his neck under his shirt. This was his only real weapon now, and it was strictly for defense. But Court had well-practiced edged weapon skills, and he knew a small knife could be enough for him to acquire a firearm from an enemy along the way. On his way back to his hotel room, he slipped into a little tea shop attached to a grocery store, ordered a bottle of water, and jammed himself into an isolated corner, one of the more challenging things he'd pulled off all week considering the crowds here in the city. He popped an earbud into his ear and pulled out his smartphone. He downloaded a commercial app that let him make encrypted calls, then dialed Suzanne Brewer, all the while keeping his eye on the movements of those around him. He knew the ambient noise in the busy shop would work to his advantage, but if anyone decided they wanted to get close or linger too long, he'd have to go mobile. The pedestrians on the sidewalk outside the window in front of him moved like cattle being pushed through a stockyard, so he really wasn't in the mood to negotiate the logistics of a clandestine conversation while shoulder to shoulder with foreign nationals. As always, Court's handler was a pro. When he called, she answered, and quickly.
Brewer.
It's me.
Identity challenge, Apollo.
Identity response, Anger.
There was a slight hesitation, and then she said,
That's a fail. You get one more chance.
Damn, thought Court.
He was out of practice with this shit. Checking in wasn't really his bag. He thought back to his daily code changes. He'd memorized them on the plane over. He knew them all, but he'd forgotten the correct sequence.
What was this, D3? What was yesterday's code?
He tried again.
Identity response, angry.
Identity confirmed.
For crying out loud, Court thought, but did not say.
He did say,
I'm in play. I made contact with Colonel Dai yesterday. He is satisfied I had nothing to do with the MSS men killed at the peninsula.
That's a relief. And what about Fan Xiang? Did Dai hire you to terminate him?
Yes. I'm on the hunt, just as planned.
While he spoke to Brewer, his eyes scanned back and forth, searching for any surveillance. But to any untrained eyes gazing his way, he just looked bored.
What have you learned about Fan's location?
Not enough. I have a lead to run down, but so far it hasn't turned into much.
What's the lead?
Nothing confirmed. We were wrong about Dai and Fitzroy being able to point us right to the objective. This is going to take some detective work.
Well, let me help you.
I will, as soon as I need help.
Brewer adopted a more severe voice now.
I detect a certain sparseness with your intel, Violator. I understand your frustration with the compromise the other day, but I won't allow you to jeopardize the mission by keeping details from me. This isn't the way you are used to dealing with things, I understand, but you aren't running the show alone anymore.
Yeah, I picked up on that when 2 jackasses followed me from the airport.
Brewer's voice stiffened even more now.
There was a mistake on our end. It's been acknowledged, so you've heard all the contrition you are going to hear from me on that. You are my agent. My agent. You managed to get this op back on track, and for that I am thankful, but now you need to do your job, and that means keeping me in the loop.
Court wanted to crush the phone with his hand. He told himself he didn't need an angry nanny. But in actuality, he did.
All right. I'm looking for a boat that was at the mouth of the bay near the public ferry dock at Potoy Island on Sunday night.
Court could hear typing in the background. What's the name of the vessel? She asked.
I don't know.
Tonnage? Type? Registry?
Nope, nope, and nope.
How do you even know that?
Because a nervous bartender looked out to a spot in the water.
I'm sorry?
I told you what I had was thin.
After a moment to get her bearings, Brewer told Court to wait while she checked the Automatic Identification System vessel tracking website, marinetraffic.com, looking for any vessel that moored in or around the bay at Potoy Island the previous Sunday night. When the screen came up, she told Court there were a few small fishing boats, but nothing larger than that. But Court already knew the search would be a long shot. Most ships were not required to squawk an identity code if their gross weight was less than 300 tons, and in the case of whatever vessel Fitzroy's men had boarded, it seemed clear it would be running black no matter the tonnage. If it was transporting Fon or providing the location of some sort of meat for a group of triads, he couldn't imagine they would squawk their identity and location. When Brewer seemed to draw a blank, Court said,
Look, I need to get back to work. When I have a lead I think you can help with,
Brewer interrupted him. I've got it.
You've got what?
Satellite images. Not from Sunday night, we weren't overhead then, but from 1300 hours on Monday. There is a cargo ship in the south of the bay, nothing else around the island, even a fourth of the size. We have a shot from Tuesday, too. Yes, still there, in the same place.
Court just muttered. Wow.
He was impressed with the fast work of Brewer and CIA. Brewer said, I guess the gray man doesn't have his own satellite.
It's in the shop.
She ignored the joke. The ship was still there Wednesday, but after that it's gone.
Can you see the name?
The angle is no good to read the bow. It's the same shot each day, more or less. I guess it didn't move around very much while it was there. I'll be able to ID the make of the ship in a second, running it through a scan. There are no goods on the deck, but there is a crane for loading items into the cargo holds. I see a couple of men here and there showing up in different locations, but other than these deckhands, no activity. She then gave him the manufacture information of the ship and told him there were 343 known to be in operation around the world and over 90 in Southeast Asia. I can run down locations on all of these, but it will take a couple of hours. For those that aren't squawking their codes, I can dig into ownership information, try to find out where they are as well. Court thanked her with a promise to check back later, then signed off. He bought some clothes and other items from nearby shops, went back to his hotel room for an hour and a half to open his new gadgets and test them out, then repacked them in his backpack. He dressed in a dark long-sleeve but breathable hemp shirt, dark brown linen drawstring pants, and black trail running shoes. He would look like an adventure tourist inside an establishment or walking the village, but he knew his earth-tone colors would allow him to move with some camouflage in the foliage of the island, if necessary. Court returned to Po Toy on the ferry, arriving shortly after 7 p.m. There were many more fishing boats out in the bay now as the sun began to set, but the bartender he'd caught looking out to the bay had been gazing out farther than any other vessel had moored or anchored, so Court didn't suspect that anything bobbing in the water now was related to Fan Xiang and the missing Fitzroy assets. He walked off the public pier with the rest of the light load of ferry passengers, then continued through the little village. There were a few Westerners and other tourists walking around, taking pictures and drinking beer in simple cafes a few blocks inland. Court imagined Po Toy couldn't have been on any travel publication's list of the top 100 things to do in Hong Kong. There wasn't much to see here at all, but there was just enough tourist action around that he didn't look completely out of place walking the streets. After strolling through just a few blocks in the village, he found himself climbing a winding trail that led up a wooded hill, past a few tin shacks, and then quickly into a steeply graded path that wound through granite boulders and thick brush. After a 10-minute walk, he found himself at the summit, which offered an excellent vantage point on the bay below. Here he sat on a flat boulder and surveyed the entire area, from the beat-up little bar he'd visited earlier in the day in the distance below him on his right, to the village and public pier directly below him, and then, to his left, a rocky beach in front of a higher hill devoid of any man-made structures. In the water directly in front of him, he saw nothing but fishing boats and other small craft. He spent the remaining moments of daylight scanning them carefully with his high-power binoculars, until the sun set fully and darkness enveloped the island. He called Brewer back and found that of all the ships of the type she'd seen on sat images at Po Toi earlier in the week, 81 of the 91 known to be operating in Southeast Asia were displaying their AIS identification information. She listed the names and registry information of the 10 that were not transmitting, but Court only wrote down the ones that were truly off-grid, as 4 of the 10 were known to be in shipyards at the moment. She had one other piece of interesting information, although he didn't know exactly what to make of it. Checking older satellite images of the area, she determined that the cargo ship they were trying to identify had been showing up in Po Toi every 5 to 10 days for the last several months. On all other occasions except for this week, it had remained only a few hours. Brewer had been trying to find it on other sat images to tell Court where it came from, but these were the most congested shipping lanes in the world, so this had proved tough going. Court hung up with Brewer and then decided he'd spend the night right here, watching the area down below, trying to spot any evidence of interesting activity here in or around the bay. If one of the ships matching a name on his list showed up, he'd swim out to it if he felt he could do so in a low-profile manner. If not, he'd just call it into Brewer, have her look into the vessel if he could find anything for her to look into. Other than this thin plan, he had no clear picture of what he was going to do here, but he knew what he was not going to do. He told himself he wasn't going to try to Sherlock Holmes his way through this. Fan Xiang could be getting farther and farther away from him, which would mean his op for the CIA would fail, and it would put his old handler Fitzroy in mortal peril. He was here to find a clue, and if he had to rush headlong into the situation to get the information he needed, that was just what he was going to do. He'd strong-arm, he'd break teeth, he'd do whatever was necessary to get answers. At 8:50 p.m., a paramilitary operator working for Russian Foreign Intelligence lay in the overwatch position to the southeast of the bay, his eye in the scope of his suppressed sniper rifle. Slowly, he moved his arm off the buttstock, then triggered his inter-team radio headset with the push-to-talk button on his chest. He spoke without taking his eyes out of the scope of his VSS rifle. Softly, the Russian said,
"Anna 7 for Sarina, over."
It was quiet in the dark hide, other than a warm evening breeze rustling the dry scrub brush around the prostate man, occasionally blowing enough to wave the wide brim of his dark green camo boonie hat. The hat, like the rest of his gear, had been purchased at a hunting supply store in HK, so there were no tags or brands that would associate him with Russia. A reply came through Anna 7's earpiece, delivered in Zoya Zakharova's unmistakable, intelligent, and sultry voice.
"Go for Sarina 7."
Anna 7 was a 31-year-old operator named Mikhail.
"She's right on time."
Through his scope, Mikhail watched the Tai Chin 6 approaching the island up the sea lane from the southwest. It was already slowing, heading toward its normal anchoring position at the mouth of the bay.
"Bunaya," replied Zakharova.
"Understood." Then she said,
"Alert me instantly if anyone leaves for shore."
"Yes, ma'am."
Court finished a bag of crackers, swatted at a fly, then stood to loosen his tight back muscles. He couldn't fully stretch out, his 3.5-week-old gunshot graze to the right side of his ribcage, while fully closed and mostly healed, still stung like hell when he reached over his head with his right hand or did anything that involved twisting or rotating his torso. Still, Court Gentry was a man who had grown accustomed to dealing with pain in his life, to the point where it felt almost jarring for him to wake up in the morning without noticing an immediate ache somewhere on his body. After he sat back down, he reached for his binos to scan along the bayside, but before he brought the optics to his eyes, he noticed something new. In the dark distance, the lights of a cargo ship moved slowly and silently around the southwestern tip of the island. This vessel was certainly no massive tanker or dry goods hauler, but it was much larger than anything else he'd seen around here. It appeared to be the one from the image Brewer had sent him earlier. Quickly, he scanned the restaurant directly below him. It was closing down. The last of the patrons were leaving, and they began walking to the public pier to catch the last ferry of the night to Hong Kong proper. Court then swept his binoculars to the right and pushed them up, where he found the derelict bar he'd dropped into before noon that day. It was nearly full now, with the opposite vibe he'd experienced when he'd sat at the bar. He didn't know where all these patrons had come from. Some were certainly locals, and others would be fishermen staying on their boats. He could see the dinghy dock floating in the water 10 feet below the railing of the establishment's deck. It was half full with rubber dinghies and wooden tenders, but looking into the little open-air dive, he saw easily 50 people, all apparently men, sitting around at tables or at the bar. He didn't think they could all be from the village and these boats. He wondered if other boats were docked offshore at other points on the island. He watched while the cargo hauler came to a stop, then dropped anchor in the same general spot the bartender at the dive bar had kept eyeing earlier in the day. Slowly, excitement began to grow in Court. Conclusive evidence? Not hardly. But he had a feeling he was onto something. The ship had closed enough to where Court could read the lighted bow with the help of his binoculars. It was the Tai Chin 6, which, he saw to his excitement, was on Brewer's list of ships that had not run their transponders on Sunday. It was registered to a freight company out of Jakarta, and Brewer had noted that it never transmitted location information, even though its gross tonnage was 745, well over the 300 tons rule. Interesting. Court just sat there, watching through the night vision binoculars, occasionally switching to his infrared monocular to scan the deck of the vessel, then sweeping the device over different fishing boats in the area, before going back to his binos to look at the crowded bar at the southwestern end of the bay. Less than 30 minutes after dropping anchor, one of 2 white tenders with outboard motors was lowered from the back of the Tai Chin 6. Several men climbed down a ladder and boarded. Court went back to his infrared device and used it to count the men on the tender. 5 white-hot human forms plus the heat from the little boat's outboard engine. As they got closer to the shore, he could see that a couple of the men wore backpacks, but otherwise they weren't carrying anything overtly on their bodies. Their tender motored directly to the dinghy dock floating below the bar he'd visited earlier in the day, and they climbed up the narrow and steep stairs to the deck of the bar. Court lowered his binos and drummed his fingers on them, trying to decide what to do. It did not take him long. He realized he'd accomplished as much as he could sitting on this hill. Now it was time to stir things up, to play the role of agitator. He would go to the bar, where he would stand out like a sore thumb, but he would try to get close to someone from that boat, or any Wo Xing Wo triads involved with Fan Qiang. He'd try to get bad actors to reveal themselves, using his own proximity as a lure. If they were tied to whatever happened to Fitzroy's men, well, then Fitzroy's new man would probably find some trouble too. And Court was looking for trouble tonight. Before leaving his overwatch position, Court took a device out of his bag and turned it on. It was one of the wireless cameras he'd bought at the surveillance shop earlier in the day. Smaller than a deck of cards, it would run for 8 hours on a single charge and send video directly to Court's mobile phone. The camera had a motor to pan left and right on a small disc, but Court just tied it to a branch on a nearby tree with pipe cleaners bought for the task, rendering it stationary. The wire in the pipe cleaners allowed him to adjust the angle of the camera somewhat, so he maxed out the 10-power zoom with the app on his phone, then physically adjusted the camera till he had it centered on the cargo ship anchored 500 yards away. It wasn't the closest view of the ship, but with a single sweep of the mobile app, he could switch the low-light vision of the camera to infrared view, and using this, he could see figures standing on the deck, represented as red hot spots. With his camera, he could keep an eye on the ship without yanking his binos or monocular out of his backpack in the middle of the bar, a tactic he couldn't imagine he could pull off while remaining covert. At 9:40 p.m., Court flicked his pack over his shoulder and began moving down the hill. Chapter 14. There was another vessel in the water near Po Toi Island, but Court couldn't see it. It lay at anchor off the eastern shore, some 2.5 miles east of the bay, and it was impressive to look at on the outside. But as luxury yachts went, the current occupants found it almost as cramped on the inside as living in military barracks.